You are tuned in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
The lobbyists write the rules, the lobbyists write the laws, and we ended up with the media system that we have, which is a nightmare. We need to create something new in this country called independent public broadcasting. We need a public trust fund for public broadcasting. We need people to be able to divert tax money to independent nonprofit journalism. We need to break up the monopolies, and then we'd have a mixed media system, and we might have an informed electorate, and we might save democracy.
That's Jeff Cohen, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Jeff Cohen, Break Up the Media Monopolies. Concentration of any industry is dangerous, but media concentration is particularly dangerous because of the vast influence media exert in shaping public opinion. Years ago, legendary journalist and media critic Ben Bagdikian warned of the dangers posed by media monopolies. Those warnings have been borne out. A handful of mega corporations, from Comcast to Disney, dominate the media. As Bagdikian predicted, corporate business interests would trump journalism, particularly investigative journalism, which is costly, thus cutting into corporate profits. Lack of competition allows the conglomerates to raise prices. Have you looked at your cable bill lately? Furthermore, a vibrant democracy is ill-served by a corporate media that is heavily connected to and reliant on official sources. An informed citizenry is essential for the communication needs of a democratic society. Media monopolies should be broken up. Our guest today is Jeff Cohen. He founded Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the Media Watch Group, in 1986. He was founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, where he was an associate professor of journalism. And he co-founded the group RootsAction.org. He spoke at the Civic Media Center in Gainesville, Florida, in mid-February. And now, Jeff Cohen.
I founded FAIR in 1986. We pioneered in statistical studies of who gets to speak in mainstream news outlets, who gets quoted as an expert, and who doesn't. These studies are not complicated. It's as simple as counting. In every study, whether it was who gets quoted in the front pages of the New York Times or in Washington Post, or who gets interviewed more at length on public broadcasting, NPR, PBS, there's a bias in favor of corporate voices and a bias against public interest voices, progressives, union, environmental, or peace voices. And I could make it more concrete by explaining that there are many different kinds of academic think tanks in Washington, D.C., from right to left ideologically, from pro-corporate to a few that are pro-union, from a number that are very hawkish and pro-U.S. military intervention to a few that are anti-war, like the Institute for Policy Studies or the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And over the decades, FAIR studies have been consistent. They show that mainstream prestige news outlets, sometimes called the corporate liberal media, these outlets consistently favored pro-corporate and hawkish think tank experts. And it's virtually never pointed out by the journalist or the interviewers that these very hawkish think tanks in Washington, D.C. are heavily funded by the big military contracting corporations. As FAIR studies have shown, these national outlets are not presenting a balanced spectrum of views in keeping with the needs of democracy or in keeping with fair journalism, but rather they're shaping discussion in pro-corporate, pro-war directions. They're shaping public opinion in those directions. I'll never forget our very first study of the public TV, PBS NewsHour. It was a six-month study of their guest list, and it found a reliance on two Washington, D.C. think tanks to the near exclusion of all others. On foreign policy, they turned repeatedly to the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a hawkish think tank. And on domestic policy, they turned over and over to the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, which is funded by some of the biggest corporations in our country. In the 1990s, when healthcare reform was a big topic in the news, National Public Radio regularly presented debates on healthcare policy that featured a former Democratic Congress member and a former Republican Congress member, so it had the semblance of balance. Both former Congress members agreed that single-payer universal health coverage, which is now called Medicare for All, it's unworkable, it's unrealistic, it's a non-starter. NPR didn't inform its listeners that both former Congress members were currently lobbyists or consultants for corporate healthcare interests opposed to Medicare for All. If you followed the non-debate in U.S. media about Russia's horrific invasion of Ukraine, you're hearing, as usual, from a lot of formers, former generals, former high-level CIA officials, State Department, Defense Department officials. And as a news consumer, you need to remember that most of the time when you hear some guest introduced only by their former official title, you're probably being lied to. Many of these formers who regularly discuss U.S. foreign policy are currently paid by the war industries, or they work for the think tanks that are funded by the war industries. And you're not told that. It's a gentleman's agreement by which these news outlets agree only to identify people by their former titles and not by their current employment or current entanglements that might actually be more relevant information to the news consumer in weighing what these formers are saying. And I should point out, in 2008, the great investigative reporter David Barstow, he wrote an article on the front page of the New York Times where he identified all of the military analysts that had been featured on the TV networks, including PBS, in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and during the occupation of Iraq. And he not only revealed that these individuals, these formers, were getting talking points, that they were being presented as military analysts retired from the Pentagon, but they were getting talking points from the Pentagon, and perhaps more important from my point of view, they were connected to military contracting companies, 150 different companies where these military analysts presented as independent were either consultants, lobbyists, board members, or top executives at military contractors. This story, front page with pictures of these various retired generals, front page of the New York Times, not mentioned on these networks that were criticized. He used 8,000 pages of emails and internal documents to prove his case about how these generals were junketed around, fed the talking points. The TV networks didn't acknowledge it. And then he wins the Pulitzer Prize. And they still didn't mention it. And I remember watching a nightly news show where they reported on some of the Pulitzer Prize winners that year, but they didn't mention David Barstow, who had exposed the nightly news. For decades, the top military analyst on NBC News, MSNBC, has been former General Barry McCaffrey. McCaffrey's analysis, his predictions have been over the years consistently wrong, sometimes ridiculously wrong. He disseminated many falsehoods in pushing hard for the U.S. to invade Iraq. And then several weeks into that invasion, McCaffrey declared this on MSNBC, and I'm quoting, "Thank God for the Abrams tank and the Bradley fighting vehicle," unquote. unknown to MSNBC viewers because they were not told. General McCaffrey sat on the boards of several military contractors, including IDT, which pocketed millions of dollars for its work on the Bradley and the Abrams. Before Russia invaded Ukraine a year ago, there were dissenting U.S. foreign policy experts who urged the Biden administration to try to avert the Ukraine war by publicly announcing that there would be a moratorium on Ukraine joining NATO, that there'd be no further expansion of NATO toward Russia's borders. These individuals did not get much airtime in U.S. media, and these dissenters were arguing that they were asking us to imagine if there was a powerful military alliance in the world, perhaps led by China. And every few years it was adding countries and getting closer to the U.S. And now they were going to add Mexico on U.S. border to this giant military alliance aimed at the United States. I think the U.S. government wouldn't be too happy about it. In the run-up to the invasion, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the NATO should not expand point of view was heard in mainstream news outlets in Europe and other countries, but not really in our country. As a harsh critic of U.S. mainstream media, it was a bizarre turn of events that got me inside mainstream television news. Soon after founding FAIR, I started appearing occasionally as a media critic on CNN, which was then the only cable news channel. And then I started appearing more regularly. And then they started paying me as a contributor. And then in 1996, they actually tested me to be the co-host of one of their biggest shows, which was their debate show called Crossfire. And during this process of testing and hiring that went on for weeks, I co-hosted five different Crossfire shows. I was pulled aside by a top CNN executive who explained to me what CNN's concern was about hiring someone like me, that I would be too critical of the nightly sponsor of Crossfire. At the time, the nightly sponsor was General Electric, a company I was known to be a critic of. Needless to say, I did not get that job. At FAIR, we had long criticized and exposed advertiser influence over news media, and here it was happening to me. I spent the next 5 years as a paid on-air commentator and debater on a new cable news channel, Fox News, owned by Rupert Murdoch. Out of more than 100 paid contributors, I was one of two progressives, and that's what they called at Fox News, fair and balanced. In 2002, I took a full-time job at the third of three cable news channels, MSNBC, run by NBC News. At the time, it was a corporate centrist and often censorial channel owned by General Electric. Today, though it's anti-Trump, it remains a corporate centrist channel and often censorial, now owned by the powerful communications company known as Comcast. When Comcast lobbyists were working hand in glove with Trump's Federal Communications Commission to undermine net neutrality, to undermine an open internet, that activity was not covered on MSNBC. I worked at MSNBC as an on-air debater in every afternoon, and also behind the scenes as a senior producer on what was generally the most watched program on that channel, the Phil Donahue Primetime Show. For those of you who are very young, you may not know, Phil Donahue was a pioneer in daytime talk television. He had a huge show. He's the one who opened the door for Oprah Winfrey. My time at MSNBC was a time of crisis for the mainstream media as a whole. What was the crisis? It was during the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. The Bush White House kept putting out exaggeration after exaggeration, lie after lie, about the Iraqi threat. And it's the job of journalists to expose official deception. And that was the crisis. In mainstream outlets overseas, these deceptions, which were easily debunkable, were exposed almost as soon as they came out of the Bush-Cheney White House, but not in our country, where the New York Times front pages not only promoted these deceptions, but embellished them. And the same for the Washington Post editorial pages. And television news was probably the worst culprit. Fear-mongering, war preparation, war itself are all great for building TV audience. At the Donahue Show, in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, we tried to do independent journalism. We tried to be skeptical, as journalists are supposed to be, about what the Bush White House was saying. We tried to book experts who were beyond all the usual suspects from these hawkish think tanks. But the top network executives at MSNBC obstructed us time and time again. When we booked an ex-UN weapons inspector, an expert on weapons of mass destruction, who said accurately, it turns out, that Iraq represented no threat whatsoever, management insisted that we have a pro-war advocate to outshout him. At one point, we booked a former attorney general turned peace advocate, Ramsey Clark, who on our show eloquently pointed out that invasion of Iraq would be immoral, it would be illegal, it would kill many Iraqi civilians. And we were told the very next morning that we had totally screwed up, that Ramsey Clark is never supposed to appear on this channel. There was some sort of blacklist we hadn't been told about. And remember, this was 2002, not 1952, during the height of the Joe McCarthy witch hunts. As the war came closer, management basically took over the primetime Phil Donahue show at MSNBC and imposed a quota system on us. They said, if we booked a guest who was opposed to the impending invasion of Iraq, we had to book two pro-war guests. If we booked two guests on the left, we had to book three guests on the right. At one meeting of all of the producers, and a producer somewhat excitedly said that she thought she could book the filmmaker Michael Moore as a guest, and he was known as someone critical of war with Iraq. She was told for political balance, she would have to have three right-wingers to balance Michael Moore. After all this obstruction, 3 weeks before the invasion of Iraq, the Donahue show was simply terminated. You know, journalists are supposed to expose lies, not disseminate them. Management immediately told the press that the reason for the termination was simply disappointing ratings. But the day after we were terminated, and God bless whistleblowers, someone at the high level of NBC News got hold of internal NBC memos and leaked them to a blogger. And these internal memos showed that NBC's objection to our show were purely political. We were simply too skeptical about war with Iraq. One NBC memo said, quote, Donahue represents a difficult public face for NBC in a time of war. He seems to delight in presenting guests who are anti-war, anti-Bush, and skeptical of the administration's motives, unquote. Gee, I thought the job of journalists, the mission of journalists in a free society, was to be skeptical of the powers that be. This memo went on to express management's fear that Donahue would be, and I'm quoting, a home for the liberal anti-war agenda at the same time that our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity, unquote. During this period, MSNBC tried to outfox Fox. After they terminated the Donahue show, they picked up the flag. And what we learned in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq is that when journalists are so busy waving flags, they sometimes don't have the energy to ask the tough questions before our young men and women are sent overseas to kill or be killed. Within months, when the Iraq occupation turned into a quagmire, when no weapons of mass destruction were found, the Donahue show was completely vindicated by events. What we were trying to do was completely vindicated, but most of us were never rehired in mainstream media. Phil Donahue was not rehired. While those in the mainstream media who got their facts and their analysis completely wrong, and that was 95% of mainstream media journalists, many of them saw their careers promote upward. You know, you hear from a lot of political leaders, some academics, especially conservatives, that we should have a meritocracy where you promote upward based on your individual achievement, your accomplishments, your performance. What I saw in corporate news media is they have the opposite of that. There's a word for it. It's called kakistocracy. It literally means rule by the worst. It's where the people that have the least competent, the least suitable, see their careers promote upward. I saw that up close. From inside mainstream media, I learned that these media organizations were strict corporate hierarchies. There are, of course, decent, ethical journalists throughout, but the decision-making and the hiring power is at the top. It's with these news executives who are hired by the media conglomerates. And those top executives are very good at enforcing discipline on any journalist who might stray. And when a show like Phil Donahue's primetime show is terminated and we're fired, it sends a message to those media employees that retain their jobs, a message of conformity. What I saw inside television news was not just political censorship, but I want to talk about a more subtle commercial pressure that can influence or deform mainstream news. As a senior producer at MSNBC, I learned that while pumping up the audience ratings, the audience numbers was important, even more important was pumping up the demo. The demo are viewers aged 25 to 54. The demo is defined as viewers, quote, young enough to change their buying habits, old enough to have disposable incomes, unquote. It's because of the power of corporate advertisers over that television executives strive to attract these sought-after viewers in the demo. And it wasn't until about a decade after I'd been banished from mainstream media that I began reflecting back on the demo. And it was because the Democratic Socialist Bernie Sanders was making his first run for president with all these youthful supporters, voters, volunteers. And mainstream media pollsters started asking the public, do you have a favorable or an unfavorable view of socialism? And to the U.S. public, I can only guess that they equated socialism, their interpretation of socialism, is what Bernie's for, and maybe later what AOC and a couple others are for. But lo and behold, in so many of these mainstream media polls, then and since, much of the public under 35, under 40, has a very favorable view towards socialism. And this brings me to one of the myths of capitalism. It's this tale that consumers are actually in charge, that the capitalists will trip over each other in competition to meet consumer demand, to meet consumer wants, consumer needs. Needless to say, at MSNBC or NBC News owned by Comcast, or ABC News owned by Disney, or Fox News owned by Rupert Murdoch, or any of these other places, when they discovered through mainstream media polls that millions of young viewers, potential young viewers in the demo, had this quite favorable view toward socialism, they didn't go out and hire a bunch of TV anchors and TV commentators who were pro-socialist. Not a single one was hired. I look at MSNBC every day, every night. I see more Republican pundits than I see pundits who are strongly pro-Bernie. The lesson here, and this is what I saw inside mainstream television news, is that while audience numbers and the demo are important, even more important usually is news content that does not offend powerful corporate interests. In most electoral democracies across the globe, not just ours, there's way too much corporate control, corporate dominance of news media. But in other countries, They have well-funded, very powerful public broadcasting channels, often the most watched channels in European countries are public broadcasting, with either no commercials or very strong limits on commercials. And unlike these other countries with the strong public broadcasting, in our country, broadcasting and television from the beginning has been dominated by commercialism, by corporate owners, by corporate advertisers, with very weak and unfortunately often timid public broadcasting. Just compare how much money, how much tax money per person per year goes to public broadcasting in various countries. In Germany, about $140 per person per year tax money goes to public broadcast. Scandinavian countries, it averages about $100 per person. In Britain, largely the BBC, it's about $80 per person. Japan and Spain, it's about $55. Canada, largely the CBC, it's only $27 per person. What is it in our country per person per year in tax money that goes to public broadcasting? It's $3 per person. And into that vacuum, corporate sponsors that are euphemistically called corporate underwriters have often stepped in. And they too often decide which programs go on the air, which programs stay on the air, and which programs fail. It's what we call the privatization of public television. Given my experiences inside mainstream news during the first years of the so-called war on terror, it's been truly strange for me personally to see the mainstream U.S. news coverage of Russia's horrific invasion of Ukraine. Every day in Ukraine coverage, there is a focus, an all-out, heartrending focus on the civilian victims of that war, as there should be in news coverage of all warfare. But when the U.S. military was invading countries, civilian victims of the U.S. war were generally off limits, and everyone in our newsrooms knew that. Soon after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001, CNN management issued these memos to all of its correspondents and anchors, and these memos that were never supposed to go public leaked out to the Washington Post. Those memos are revealing and they're maddening because CNN executives were instructing their journalists to marginalize or excuse the killing and maiming of Afghan civilians by the U.S. military. One of these memos instructed CNN anchors that if there ever was a reference to an Afghan civilian casualty of the U.S. invasion, they were to quickly intercede and announce, quote, "These U.S. military actions are in response to a terrorist attack that killed close to 5,000 innocent people in the U.S., unquote. This was a few weeks after 9/11. Who'd forgotten that? This was right after the terror attacks, but it was mandatory. How do I know it was mandatory? Because the CNN memo that leaked out said, even though it may start sounding rote, it's important that we make this point each time, unquote.
You're listening to Jeff Cohen, Break Up the Media Monopolies. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So jump from the CNN directives at the beginning of the U.S. war in Afghanistan to when the war was winding down 20 years later. Afghan civilian victims of the U.S. were still being erased. I was watching NBC Nightly News when they did their sum up, and it's anchored by Lester Holt, who I worked with at MSNBC. He's not one of the worst journalist in television news. He's actually one of the better ones. But he gives this summing up on Afghanistan. He calls it America's longest war. And he provides one and only one casualty figure. He said 2,300 American deaths. No mention of the more than 70,000 Afghan civilians who had been killed. No mention of a recent United Nations study that had found that because of the bombing from the air, more civilians in Afghanistan were being killed by the U.S. and its allies.